Dear friends of Jesus Christ, I don't know how many of you have heard talk of the emergent or emerging church. I've heard some of it. I've read a couple of books about it. It's a movement or conversation among Christians in North America, Australia, and Europe about, well, primarily, I think, being authentic in a postmodern age. As you listen to them, they're critical of the established church. They feel disenfranchised. And it doesn't matter whether it's liberal or fundamentalist, whether it's a small steeple-like church or a mega church. They feel very much that the church needs to strive after authenticity, to be real. Some of the people that are spokespeople of this movement, this conversation, are people like, I hear Rob Bell's name mentioned, Brian McLaren, Shane Claiborne. But their emphasis is on being real. They're much more relational. They're sort of against organizations and institutions. Anyway, as I read about them and listen to them, and as I'm also listening to the Apostle Peter, I was thinking, you know, Peter would love to be a part of that conversation, to be at the table, so to speak, because what you find with the Apostle Peter is that he is very much about authenticity, that our lives be an authentic reflection of the faith that we profess. And so if we say that we are a people on whom God has set his love before there were stars in the heavens, and that he has given us a new birth into a living hope and into an inheritance that cannot perish, why, that confession ought to be shaping our lives, embodying our conduct. It ought to be an authentic existence. Now, when you come to these verses in 1 Peter 17 through 21, in the Greek it's just one sentence. And it seems to me the main clause in this sentence is the last phrase in verse 17, namely, that we live in reverent fear during the time of our exile. And then the rest is really an explanation as to why we should live in reverent fear. Now, in the NIV, it translates this way, that we live here as strangers in reverent fear. Now, the emphasis is not on the fact that we are strangers or that we are living in exile. We've talked about that before. It's an exile that is due to the fact that we have responded to the gospel faithfully, so that we are no longer declaring Caesar as Lord, but Jesus Christ. And that confession places us outside the mainstream of things. We're a different people. We're a unique people. We're the strangers in the world. And as strangers, to live authentically, we must live in reverent fear. So what I want to do this morning is to simply explore what that means, this reverent fear, and then the basis for it, namely that we invoke a God who is a Father, who is impartial, and that we confess ourselves to have been ransomed, not with gold or silver, but with the precious blood of Christ, which has caused us to set our trust or our faith and hope in God. So let's begin with this main thing, this fear, this reverent fear. In the Greek, there's just one word. There's no word for reverent. It's simply phobos, which is, of course, the word from which we get phobia, fear. But it's a fear that's not just any kind of fear, but that it harks back to what is a common description of the godly life, namely, a fear of the Lord, right? You find that in the Old Testament, you find that in the New Testament, a fear of the Lord. And so the translators, wanting to capture that, speak of a reverent fear. That they want to distinguish it from being terrorized by God or totally ambivalent about him. scared. And there are times, I think, when I have been with people, and perhaps I felt it myself, when we are scared by with God because he seems so unpredictable. I remember visiting somebody once who said to me, "God is cruel, Jack. God is cruel." And that was because his sister, who had cancer for a number of years, died and left her husband and four small children. And I thought, you know, if God is cruel, then all the saints and all the scriptures are liars. And it would be impossible to adore such a God. So to be scared of God because he's unpredictable, because he has this mean, cruel streak, we must immediately distance this fear from that kind of fear. It's a reverent fear. And if you say, well, what does that mean exactly, this reverent fear? And I'm thinking it might mean something like this. It's a fear or a reverent fear that one recognizes who God is as the scriptures reveal him, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's a recognition of who God is and then responding accordingly. So that it is this God that causes this stillness in us, this reverence, this honoring. Let me explain what that might mean or look like in sort of other things. You might have, for instance, your children doing the dishes and you say, "Be careful with that, honey." Because it's maybe precious china or it's something that you got from your great-grandparents. And you're thinking that if they know what it is, they'll respond accordingly. You know, and as I was thinking about that, I remember something that struck me so when I first read it. You know Alexander Solzhenitsyn? He's this Russian writer. Back in the 60s, when Khrushchev was prime minister of the Soviet Union, and there was a liberalization going on in the Soviet Union. And so Solzhenitsyn sent a manuscript of a short novel that he had written about the labor camps to the editor of a big magazine in Moscow. And the novel was A Day in the Life of, Ivan Denisovich, or whatever. But anyway, A Day in the Life of Ivan. And here's what happened. It was given to the editor of that magazine, who took the manuscript and stuffed it into his briefcase with other manuscripts. He went home, and then he did what he always did. He ate a quick meal, got into his PJs, propped himself up in bed, and then started to read the manuscripts. But when he came to this manuscript that was sent by Solzhenitsyn, he almost immediately realized that he had in his hands a Russian classic. And he got out of bed, put on his suit, and sat behind his desk, and for the rest of the night, he read this book. When he recognized what he was dealing with, it changed his behavior. It is recognizing God. Eugene Peterson, who has this study on spirituality called Christ in 10,000 Places, he thinks that the fear of the Lord is one of the main ways in which the Christian's authentic life must come to expression. And he says this fear of the Lord, it is to be cultivated in prayer and in worship. Because he says, in those places, we intentionally and deliberately stop our preoccupation with ourselves, and we intentionally place ourselves in sacred time, in sacred space. We begin now and again, isn't that so? Now and again, we get this sense that this place is holy place. Again, Peterson says, this cultivation, this nurturing, the fear of the Lord, means that in prayer and in stillness, we cultivate this sense of the more and the other. And that this sense of the more and the other convicts us that we are not at the center of things, that it's not all about us, that we are not ultimately in control, but that it is about God. This fear, this reverent fear, this sense of the other, this deep conviction of the more. You know, I've been mentioning, not lately, but anyway, I've mentioned this book by Charles Taylor, A Secular Age. In the beginning of that book, he quotes someone that I don't know, a guy by the name of Bede Griffith, who was a believer, a Christian, who described in his autobiography when it happened that he became a believer. He was out in the woods. Anyway, the whole thing is about how he is overwhelmed by the presence of God in nature, the majesty of God. And I want to read to you this final part of that long quote. He said, I remember now the feeling of awe which came over me. I felt inclined to kneel on the ground as though I had been standing in the presence of an angel. And I hardly dared to look on the face of the sky because it seemed as though it was but a veil before the face of God. Now listen to that final phrase. I hardly dared to look on the face of the sky because it seemed as though it was but a veil before the face of God. And for you and me to have a fear of God is to see all of creation, and not just nature, but the faces around you as but veils before the face of God. So that you're almost sometimes tempted to part the veil, to look upon the face of God, to look on the face of God. I'm thinking that if you and I were to see all things as but the veil before the face of God, it would inspire in us and nurture in us a reverent fear, and it would be the cause for justice and mercy and humility, this fear of the Lord, to see all of creation as but a veil before the face of God. To live with that, to nurture that seeing eye. Anyway, Peter says authentic living as believers is a reverent fear, and that he doesn't go out into the woods to cultivate this. He speaks, first of all, that in our prayer life, we invoke the Father who is impartial, who judges all people impartially according to their deeds. Now, this impartiality. On the one hand, when I was reading that, I was thinking, but you know, there are lots of references in the Bible about God's partiality, right? I mean, he's very partial towards widows and orphans and the weak and the powerless, the marginalized people. God takes their stand. He has an eye on them. So what does this impartiality here mean? And here I need to just depend on people who know their Greek, because one commentator that I read says that this impartiality means that God acts towards us without regard, and this is sort of literal, without regard to our face. And according to the commentator, what that means is that God is towards us and he's indifferent to our status or our role in society. I mean, the kind of thing that sways us, let's be honest, we are impressed with successful people whose role and status are way up there. And when you're way up there, it is easy sometimes to rest on that. To say with the people who came to John the Baptist, we are children of Abraham. We are children of success. People and nations listen to. I mean, you know, that kind of... And now there are all these ways in which we gain privilege. You know, whether it's status, whether it's because of our race or because of our intellects or because we've got all these books to our credit or you name it. And now Peter says, listen, you know this. The God whom we invoke doesn't give a red cent about status or role, fame or looks. What God looks for is the deeds, and whether the deeds are transparent to an alliance that he has formed with you, whether there is in the way we live signs of a fear of God. You see? So that it's, again, you know, it's not what you do, it's how you do them. You know, the Puritans, they spoke of God loving the adverb. It's how we do things. And so Peter says, because you know this, you will, of course, seek to nurture and cultivate a reverent fear. But that's not the only reason. He also says the reason for this reverent fear, for this honoring God, is due to the fact that we have been ransomed. What does he say? You know that you were ransomed from the futile ways ways inherited from your ancestors, not with perishable things like silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ. Now, this word ransom is a word that comes not out of the temple, but out of the marketplace. It's not a religious ritual, it's sort of a financial transaction. And this kind of ransoming would go on. For instance, if you were a prisoner of war, your country could buy you back. Or if you were a slave, you could either collect enough money to ransom your own freedom, or someone else could buy your freedom. There was a ransoming. In the Old Testament, it was very common for, say, a next of kin to buy back either you yourself, who had been sold into slavery because you were in debt, or to buy back land that you had lost because you weren't managing it right. You remember in the story of Ruth, Boaz is called a kinsman redeemer. This ransom, it's a ransoming, it's a liberating, it's a freeing, it's a redeeming. And we are redeemed not from Pharaoh, but from a way of life, from the brickyards of Egypt, from this futility. Now, what would it mean for us to talk about being ransomed from the futile ways that we inherited from our ancestors? You know Mark Twain, who wrote Tom Sawyer. Mark Twain was a very sad person and very, very, you know, anti-Christian. Was terribly disappointed in many things. And in his autobiography, he gives a description of what seems to me a futile life. He says, listen to this, he says, "A myriad of men are born. They labor and sweat and struggle for bread. They squabble and scold and fight. They scramble for little mean advantages over each other. But then age creeps upon them and infirmities follow. Shames and humiliations bring down their prides and their vanities. Those they love are taken from them, and the joy of life is turned to grief. The burden of pain, care, misery grows heavier year after year. At length, ambition is dead, pride is dead, vanity is dead, longing for release is in their place. And it comes at last, the only unpoisoned gift earth ever had for them. And they vanish from a world where they were of no consequence, where they achieved nothing, where they were a mistake and a failure and a foolishness, where they left no sign that they had ever existed, a world that will lament them for a day and forget them forever." I mean, there's this profound futility in our existence. We are born, we live, we die, and within 2-3 generations, nobody will remember us or give one red cent about what we struggled with. This futility, that at the end of all your striving, you and I hit a wall and not a door. And now Peter says, the reason that we are a people of reverent fear is because we have been ransomed from that futility, from that awful nothingness that looms over us. We have been ransomed, and Peter says we've been ransomed not with gold or silver, but with the precious blood of Christ. And then he hauls in images from the Old Testament, the sacrificial lamb who was slain for the sins of the people, the Passover lamb who was slain so that the angel of death might pass over us, the lamb that was led to the slaughter and did not complain. Peter brings in this image of Christ as the lamb whose blood was spilled, whose life was given so that we might be freed, so that we might be liberated and translated or relocated from this futile way of life to a life that is brimming with hope, full of glory. You see, what's important here, it seems to me, is not first of all from what we've been delivered, but the price that was paid for us to be delivered. And the price that has been paid for our deliverance is nothing less than the life of the Son of God. And one commentator makes a really important point. He says, you know, Peter is still in that first generation of Christians, and they don't have their Trinity all worked out, but there is this mixing of God and Christ, so that sometimes you hardly know whether the one is talking about this one or that one. And yet, he says it's because the Christian conviction is this, that our ransoming was not done by a third party, so that God there and you and I here and some third party has moved in to ransom us, but God himself is busily ransoming us. It is God's Son. God showed his love for us in that his Son came to deliver us. That Christ is the very presence of God seeking to ransom us. You know, this is, of course, this is the old story. By the way, we celebrate that. I like this very much about our doing communion every Sunday. It is a reminder that Christ is not a teacher or a hero or an example, but that he is the one who gives his life to you so that you might take his life in and be incorporated into that everlasting community that will not perish. He comes to give life, right? It is such a wonderful thing if we think about it, if you enter into it. And as I said, I was trying to say, oh, how can we get into that? And this may not help you, but you know, Wes Cranberg Michelson, I don't know how many of you know him. He's the Secretary General of the Reformed Church of America, and he's a regular attender here. He comes at the 8:30 service. Anyway, he sent me an email. He'd been in New York when the Pope Benedict was there. And he, with other church leaders, had a worship service, and afterwards they had met the Pope. And there's this gorgeous picture of Pope Benedict holding Wes's hands in both his hands and looking at him and talking as though he has no one else to think about or talk to. It is a glorious picture. In fact, we sent it to a Catholic friend of ours who emailed back, oh, breathtaking. Who is this friend of yours? You know, and it is. And Wes is so pleased with it, and it was a wonderful moment in his life, he says. But I thought what would really make it special would be if that picture were now hanging on the bedroom wall of the papal house. Wouldn't that be something? Now that, I mean, and it seems to me, you know, I mean, for the Pope, this is a momentary, a wonderful exchange, no doubt. And I don't want to belittle it. But Christ did not come for a photo op or even to make a brief contact with us. What we say is that God came among us not to have a brief chat or to say that he understands our dilemmas, but to say, I'm going to ransom you. I'm going to prepare a place for you. Your names are written on the palm of my hands. I will never forget you, and you are destined for glory. You know, the Christians who have really taken that in are just you know, amazing grace. Do you know, and this I'm going to quit, but do you know this wonderful song? It's an old gospel, the hymn, The Love of God. Here's one of the stanzas. Could we with ink the ocean fill? And were the skies of parchment made, were every stalk on earth a quill and every man a scribe by trade, to write the love of God above would drain the ocean dry, nor could the scroll contain the whole, though stretched from sky to sky. To be aware of such divine love is to be nurtured by a reverent fear. To have that divine love hold sway over us will produce among us an authentic people. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.